According to the ACCC, Australians lost $3.1 billion to scams in 2022 alone. That's thinking of Australians as the victims, but we rarely think of the fact that sometimes the perpetrators of the scams, the people on the other end of the phone lines and the like, may also be victims of crime as well. That's something our next guest knows all too well. Michael Brzozowski is the founder of the Blue Dragons Children Foundation. And in Vietnam, it's rescued over 200 people held captive at scamming compounds in Southeast Asia, many of them threatened with torture if they don't perform or if they try to leave. Since this Australian high school teacher started Blue Dragon 21 years ago, it's rescued around 2,500 people who've been trafficked into forced labour, brothels, and more recently, scamming operations. It's a remarkable story. Michael Brzozowski, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Proud to be here. Thank you.
Tell us about the beginning of your life, Michael. Where did you grow up and what did life look like for you in the early days?
Well, I was born in Sydney, grew up in the industrial suburb of Botany. My parents were factory workers. And when I was about 12, we had the great idea, let's sell up in Sydney, let's leave the city behind and start over in the countryside. So we moved to northwest New South Wales, about 600 kilometres to the northwest of Sydney, bought a patch of land, and over the years built a house, built sheds, put up fences, dug dams, and really lived a very, very rural life. And when I graduated from high school, I returned to the city to become a school teacher.
So you became a school teacher. Was that because you had some good experiences with teachers in your education, or was it the other way around?
Yeah, quite a classic story, actually, of a person from poverty looking for a way out and settling on a career that they see and understand. We were very, very poor. You know, in those years living in the countryside there, we lived in caravans on this block of land. And it's quite a common story of people who don't have a big network, who don't move in certain circles, looking to their school as the place that's a safe refuge. And so for me, my heroes were my teachers, and in particular, my English teacher. So it wasn't a big leap for me to decide, you know, the one person in my life who really understood and cared for me seemed to be an English teacher. So I'll become an English teacher too. And that was what led me into that career.
Obviously, Vietnam is a crucially important place in your life. How did you become interested in Vietnam?
Well, it goes back to me being an English teacher. I was working in Southwest Sydney in a terrific high school. A lot of my students were either Vietnamese or the children of Vietnamese immigrants or people from all around the Southeast Asia region. And I just became very, very interested in the Vietnamese culture and people. So the first time I had an opportunity to travel outside of Australia, I didn't have a big budget. And I thought, well, I've got to go to Vietnam. You know, it's affordable. And I'm so interested in understanding more about these students and these people who I know. So that was it. Got on a plane to Vietnam and did the backpacker thing. And got absolutely hooked on the country.
Hooked to the extent that you actually moved to Vietnam. And I gather that that's the year you've chosen, Michael, as the year that made you.
That's right, 2002. I went there for a few holidays before I moved. And I came back to Australia after I'd been on holidays. And I ended up leaving my job as a teacher and selling my apartment and going back to university to actually do some more study before I moved to Vietnam. So it was considered and thoughtful, but actually when I moved there in 2002, I wasn't going there with any great plan.
So why, in your mind at the time, did you move to Vietnam?
It was a few things. I loved being a teacher and I was in a great school in Sydney, but I was quite out of my depth in a way. It was a huge school, whereas I'd been in a tiny little country high school when I was a student. I was living far from family and friends. So I was having trouble, I guess, like really fitting in and finding my place. And then going to Vietnam on holiday, I felt that I really connected, that there was something there that attracted me. And I, you know, I had this draw to keep going back. So it was almost like, look, I'm not all that happy where I am right now. When I go to Vietnam, I'm very happy. why don't I just go and live in Vietnam? It was about as well thought through as that. The sort of thing you would advise your, you know, your friends, no, don't do that. That's crazy. But that's what I did. And, you know, I just turned up in Vietnam with a backpack and a carry bag and thought, okay, let's see what happens here.
And before long, you were teaching English, although I assume at this point you're teaching English in a different way. Where were you doing it?
That's right. I ended up getting kind of a volunteer position in an economics university. That was in Ho Chi Minh City in the south of Vietnam, teaching English to young adults who were studying a Master's of Development Economics. And then after a few months, I was transferred to Hanoi, to the north. I was teaching there at the university, and I was just staying in a hotel in the old quarter of Hanoi. And, you know, you'd go out and have a meal on the side of the street after work, and kids would come by shining shoes. And, you know, they'd come up to me and say, hello, shoeshine, which was often the only English they could speak. And I felt a bit uncomfortable getting kids to shine my shoes. So instead I'd say, well, sit down, and I'd buy the kids a meal and teach them a little bit of English. But as I got to know them, I kind of got to thinking, wow, you know, if I'd been born in Vietnam, this is probably what would have been my fate. I almost certainly would have ended up shining shoes on the city streets. They were all country kids who'd come in. They were making money and sending it home to their parents. So whereas I was first in Hanoi thinking, oh, I don't want to stay here for very long, I don't really know anyone here, before long I was really intrigued by this population of street kids. And then I'd go back to the university the next day and I'd share this with my students. And they would come to me saying, hey, why don't we do this together? Let's teach English. Let's have football and activities for street kids. And so it really just grew very, very spontaneously. It wasn't what I thought I was going to be doing. And next thing with my university students, I was starting up a weekly soccer club and running English classes. And it was really during those early months that the idea dawned on us that if we didn't keep doing this, then all of this would fall apart. And so we started to look around for someone else. Who is a professional? Who is someone who could actually help these kids? Because we can't. And finally, you know, we came to the realization, well, actually, we are the ones who are here and we care. We need to start an organization so that we can be here for the kids for the long term. And really, that was how Blue Dragon began. It was kind of a process of realizing, you know what, this is up to us. And at that point, we started, okay, how do we start an organization? We had no idea, and we just had to work it out.
On The Year That Made Me, we're speaking with Michael Brzozowski, the founder of the Blue Dragon Children's Foundation, which works out of Vietnam. Michael, could you tell us about the first time the Blue Dragon Foundation's work brought it into contact with a trafficked child?
Yeah, again, it was completely by accident. That's the theme of my story. I was back in Ho Chi Minh City for a few days. It was a couple of years after we'd started the organization, and there was a boy there. I worked out later he was 13 years old, and he had been trafficked to work on the streets of Ho Chi Minh City. It was pretty obvious that something was wrong. He looked very unhappy, and I was watching him at work. He was selling flowers, and every time he sold a flower, he would then take the money and give it to some women who were sitting at the end of the street, and he'd go back to selling flowers. So I got talking to him, and he was very upfront. Sometimes when you meet people who are homeless or trafficked, they may be very guarded and, you know, afraid to share anything because they don't know who you are. He was very unguarded. He was very clear. I want to get out of here. I want to go home. He was from a town about 600 kilometers north of Ho Chi Minh City. So I worked out how to get him out of there and got him back to his village. And I kind of thought, like, that'd be it, you know. Then I go back to Hanoi and life goes on. But one of our volunteers got on the train and went to this boy's village just to find out, like, make sure he's okay, see why he ended up being trafficked. And in doing that, we discovered, oh, there's a huge problem here. there were hundreds of kids who had been trafficked, not only to work on the street, but also to work in sweatshops. So from this particular community, they'd really been targeted by traffickers because of their poverty. They were kind of vulnerable to people coming along, promising them, you know, I'll give you a better life. I'll make sure your kids have a great life. Just let them come with me and I'll train them up, you know, to be a florist or to be a tailor. They were just slaves. The kids were just being put to work and were earning nothing. And when we saw that, we realized, okay, we've got to help here. So we never set out to be an anti-trafficking organization, but everything just led us to that place.
I was certainly surprised to learn that trafficking could intersect with scamming and that there's this category of forced scamming, or as the UN calls it, forced criminality. Mm. How did you become aware of this phenomenon and how does it work, Michael?
Well, so from that very, very first rescue of that 13-year-old boy, we then got involved in rescuing people from all different kinds of trafficking in various locations. The forced scamming only came up a couple of years ago during COVID, and it was just the perfect storm of conditions that made it happen. The COVID lockdowns, so everybody was going online, lawlessness in certain parts of Southeast Asia. So the scamming just started initially as casinos, actually, in Cambodia, where people had been building real, you know, in-person casinos, but because of COVID, nobody could go there. So the gangsters who were building these places took it online. And then they thought, well, we could go one extra step here. If we trick people into coming and working for us and then we don't pay them, you know, we have even more profit. So it started out as online gambling, and then the business model started to develop to what it is now, where it's very sophisticated scamming. If you can think of these places as like a call center for one of the telephone companies, where you'll have a room with 20 or 30 operators, there's a supervisor up at the front of the room, everyone's working on their terminal, and they're all following scripts. And the supervisor is there to help them if the script isn't working, to come and suggest an alternative script. It's very, very sophisticated. So people started to be trafficked into these places, not only from Vietnam, but from all around the region, and people from all backgrounds. We've rescued young people, for example, who used to be street kids. So kids who we've worked with in the past, who went off thinking they were going to an online marketing job and ended up in one of these scam compounds in Cambodia. But there are also IT professionals who've been trafficked in there thinking they were honestly going to Cambodia to work in a real job. You know, so people from all walks of life, all ages, male and female. And the current estimate is that there are about 220,000 people in that forced criminality just in Cambodia and Myanmar alone. That's how big it's become.
Yeah, it's really confronting to think that the person who's perpetrating a scam on you might in fact be a victim of a crime that may well be far, far worse than the one that you're experiencing. Michael, could you give us a sense just at the Blue Dragon Foundation level of how many people you've encountered who have fallen into this category of forced scamming and forced criminality?
Well, at the moment that we're speaking right now, we've rescued about 200 people from those places in Cambodia, Myanmar and Laos. Some of these places have popped up in Laos as well. But we're in touch with another 100 or so people at any given moment who have reached out. Maybe they've found a way to contact their family or maybe they've contacted us directly and are calling for help. We know, like, we're scratching the surface of this. We're rescuing a few hundred. And there's 200,000 who actually need to be helped. But once we get people back, we're protecting them, we're looking after them as they heal from the trauma, we're helping them report to police so trafficking rings are being broken up, and we're feeding all of that information back into the system so that more global action can be taken.
It's obviously a very grim business and business model that you are trying to rescue people from. I can only imagine that it's emotionally draining to be involved in. But what's it like when you do actually manage to rescue someone from a situation of forced criminality?
Look, I said a moment ago that we're scratching the surface. On the other hand, for that person who we rescue, we've just changed their entire world. So people right now might be thinking, well, forced criminality sounds really bad, but we haven't really touched on the half of it. People are beaten and tortured. Some of what we hear and see from the victims of this is terrifying. And one of the latest developments is that people's kidneys are removed if they don't perform well enough. You know, that's how bad it's become. So for someone to get home, they may well be crossing that border back into Vietnam thinking, I never thought I'd see my family again. We've rescued kids as young as 12 and 13 from these places, sometimes from brothels that spring up alongside the forced scamming compounds. These are young people who will always have the scars of what's happened, but because they're back, they have hope, they have chance to heal and to start life over. So it's very, very powerful. Blue Dragon is working on a broader level where we're trying to really impact the prevalence of human trafficking. We're trying to reduce it. We're trying to prevent it from happening. And as we do that, that individual level rescue that we do is just one of the most powerful things to see somebody's life transformed and given back hope.
Because these victims have also been involved in criminality, is there a risk sometimes that they might also face the legal consequences of the work that they were forced to do?
Sometimes. The Vietnamese government has been really good about that. They're really clear about who is a victim and who is a perpetrator. Some other countries in the region are a bit less clear about it. And sometimes people who are victims do end up being punished for committing crimes. I know of people who've been trafficked into Myanmar, for example, who have ended up being detained for immigration offences. It is complex and it's often a bit grey. It's not so black and white as you might think. So it takes governments a bit of time to work that out. Fortunately, the people who we've brought back, they have been recognised as victims and not punished for what they've had to do.
Hearing about forced criminality certainly changed the way I think about scamming and telephone calls, those annoying calls that you get. Does it change, in your view, the way that people should think about scams and the like when they are approached in Australia, Michael?
Oh, it's so hard because those scams are terrible things and billions of dollars have been lost. What I would say is when that call comes or when you've got those messages, hang up and report it to the Australian government. There are various websites where you can report scams, or sometimes if it looks like it's coming from your bank, you can send it on to your bank. Let them know, because the police in Australia, they need to know about this so they can also follow up. But don't be angry with the person who's calling.
Is it really valuable to be able to forward on a text message or something like that to the police?
Yeah, they need that body of evidence. They need to know the extent so that they can follow up. At the individual level, the rescues are very important, but ultimately this whole scamming system has to be shut down, and that can only happen with a coordinated global approach. So Australian police and New Zealand police working together with the governments of Cambodia and Myanmar and so on. It's highly complex, and all of that information is helpful.
Blue Dragon Children's Foundation has outlined a plan to end slavery and trafficking within 10 years. That sounds very ambitious, Michael. How optimistic are you that that could be achieved?
We are confident. We are ambitious. Now, I'm going to start out with a caveat that there'll always be human trafficking. You can't eradicate crime, but you can reduce it significantly, and you can also prepare society to cope with it when it happens. What we're seeing right now is that globally, no one really has much idea how to prevent human trafficking. There's a lot of kind of scrambling to keep up with it and attempts to minimize it here and there, but no one's really worked out, how do you stop it? And we've had a bit of success within Vietnam in stopping it. Those kids who I mentioned earlier on, who were being trafficked to work in sweatshops and on the streets, so they were from a particular part of Vietnam. That part of Vietnam, after we've worked there for more than 10 years, they don't have human trafficking there anymore. It stopped. And those sweatshops that were taking kids, they don't operate anymore. So we've had experience of actually stamping it out. We've then taken that to other parts of Vietnam and we're applying what we learn there.
So in addition to obviously the rescue activities, what other preventative activities does that entail?
It's a real combination of a few different things happening all at the same time. One is education, making sure that kids and families know how to keep themselves safe, making sure that school teachers and government officials are aware of the problem. So all of that education side. And then some of it is just straight out welfare, helping pay school fees or helping families to start their own little business so that they can earn their own money and they're less vulnerable to being trafficked. One thing we've even done is build houses for families who need them. So just very practical support. And then the third thing is handing over the responsibility of this to the community, building up local people in the community who will be on the lookout for human trafficking and take responsibility in their area to report possible trafficking or to educate the community themselves. So those things together, very, very powerful in preventing human trafficking. So we're testing this out, we're expanding it around the country and sharing everything that we learn so that it can be scaled up, mostly by the Vietnamese government because they have the reach to get right around the country and protect all of their citizens. But we're sharing that with anybody so that our work can help people in other countries as well.
Michael Przewoski, thanks so much for speaking with us on The Year That Made Me.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And we always finish The Year That Made Me with a piece of music. What have you chosen for us, Michael, and why?
I've chosen a song by Electric President called Safe and Sound. It's a beautiful and very personal song to promise hope and care for someone through their darkest times. And in our work in Blue Dragon, that's what we do. And sometimes it's also what we need and certainly what I need. So a lovely song that reminds me of the importance of caring for others.
And here it is, Safe and Sound by Electric President. Michael Przewoski, thank you once again.
Thanks, Julian.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.